The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week magazine, dated June 8, 2012. As always, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine, our first article entitled Mounting Pressure on Assad After Syria Massacre. The Obama administration and its Western allies ratcheted up the pressure on Syria's leaders this week, expelling senior Syrian diplomats to protest the massacre by pro-regime thugs of more than 100 people, mostly women and children, in the town of Hula. Declaring the Syrian government responsible for this slaughter, the State Department gave the country's top diplomat in Washington just 72 hours to leave the U.S. High-ranking Syrian envoys were also kicked out of Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Turkey, and several other countries. The expulsions came as United Nations Special Envoy Kofi Annan tried to salvage a crumbling U.N. peace plan, pleading with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus to honor a ceasefire between the regime and its opponents. Assad's government claimed that unidentified opposition terrorists were behind the Hula massacre, in which 108 civilians, including 49 children and 34 women, were slaughtered, the worst atrocity of the 14-month uprising. But UN monitors said that the attack began with a bombardment by government tanks and artillery, which killed up to 20 civilians. Pro-government parliamentaries then moved in and went house to house, shooting and savagely hacking people to bits. One witness described seeing women, children without heads, their brains or stomachs spilling out. The chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, warned that an international military intervention might become necessary if such atrocities continued. Now here's what the editorial said. This may have been the worst massacre in Syria yet, said The Guardian in the UK, but it won't be the last. The executioners are thought to have been members of the Alawite minority, a Shia offshoot to which Assad belongs, while their victims were members of the Sunni majority. Revenge attacks are likely, and if this ethnic conflict continues to escalate, Syria will disintegrate into a Lebanese-style civil war with shockwaves throughout the region. Obama must start leading from the front, said the Washington Post. For 2 months, he hid behind the toothless UN plan, which allowed the Syrian regime to go on slaughtering civilians. Now the president is trying to persuade the regime's longtime ally, Russia, to pressure Assad to step down. But that plan is doomed to fail, since Russian strongman Vladimir Putin has no interest in promoting democracy, and Syria is Moscow's last remaining client state in the Middle East. Obama should stop relying on useless middlemen and order an intervention. The longer he waits, the greater the cost in children's lives, among other things. And here's what the columnist said. Diplomacy has failed, said James Traub in foreignpolicy.com. The rebels are acquiring weapons from Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and civil war is inevitable. The U.S., Turkey, and Gulf states should give the rebel army the training ground, weapons, and logistical support it needs to win, as we did in Libya. If we keep hiding behind Kofi Annan's skirts, foreign jihadists will hijack the uprising, and the chance of creating an arguably better Syria will disappear. It's understandable that everyone is now saying, we have to do something, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times, but intervening in Syria without the protection of an international consensus would be particularly risky. The resulting factionalism and chaos could end up igniting regional and great power conflicts. An international solution is still possible, said Walter Russell Mead in the AmericanInterest.com. Obama is reportedly trying to persuade Putin to support a deal in which Assad would get a dignified exit from power. It just might work. With no end to the slaughters in sight, even Putin now sees the blood-stained and weakened Assad as more of a liability to Moscow than an asset. But even if Assad falls, the bloodshed won't stop, said Philip Gurevich in The New Yorker. The main opposition group, the Syrian National Council, is made up of 7 infighting factions, including Christians, Kurds, and the Muslim Brotherhood, who will likely turn on one another as soon as Assad is gone. A savage sectarian war, it seems, will be the dictator's final gift to his country. The next item from the main story section of the week, Romney clinches nomination. Mitt Romney secured the Republican presidential nomination this past week after a primary win in Texas pushed him past the 1,144 delegate threshold. The symbolic milestone capped a bruising 5-month battle for the GOP ticket, and Romney campaign used the occasion to begin a renewed offensive against President Obama's economic record. But Romney's historic accomplishment, he is the first Mormon to win a major party's nomination, came amid a controversy over his endorsement by real estate magnate Donald Trump. This week, Trump launched a new media blitz claiming that President Obama was not born in the U.S. Romney, who appeared at a Las Vegas fundraiser with Trump, declined to repudiate Trump for his birther allegations. "I don't agree with all the people who support me," Romney said, "but I need to get 50.1% or more." Unbelievable, said John Avalon in the DailyBeast.com. Pandering to a clownish conspiracy theorist like Trump may have been necessary to win the nomination, but the sale has now been made and Romney needs to stop being held hostage by the far right and take a stand. He has real assets in this election, like appealing personal values and a swing state-friendly economic message. But if he keeps letting extreme voices from his own party hijack the conversation, he'll scare off the independents he has to attract to win the November election. "Actually, Mitt is right where he needs to be," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Even after a bitter and ugly primary fight in which his shortcomings were endlessly aired, Romney is now in a virtual dead heat with Obama in polls. Assaults on his record at Bain Capital aren't sticking, and the economy, Romney's strongest issue, shows no sign of a robust recovery that might guarantee the president's reelection. Only the most starry-eyed Obama idolaters think Romney has no chance in November. That's why the Obama campaign is going into full attack mode, said John Heilman in New York Magazine. It plans to relentlessly portray Romney as a radical right-winger with dangerously backward social and economic ideas and a terrible job creation record as Massachusetts governor. The attacks will be rougher than anything flung at John McCain 4 years ago. Obama voters will soon see is a brass-knuckle, pipe-hitting, red-in-tooth-and-claw brawler determined to do what is necessary to stay in power, in other words, a politician. To win another term, 2008's candidate of hope stands poised to become 2012's candidate of fear. And the next item from the main story section is entitled Egypt's Stark Choice. An Islamist leader will vie with a stalwart of the old regime to become the first elected president in Egyptian history after an initial round of elections last week eliminated all the more moderate contenders. The Muslim Brotherhood's Mohammed Mursi, who has called for stricter adherence to Islamic law, finished first in the 13-candidate race with 25% of the vote. Ahmed Shakif, the last prime minister in ex-dictator Hosni Mubarak's regime, got 24% with his pledge to neutralize Islamists and restore security with an iron fist. The two will face one another in a runoff on June 16th and 17th. The outcome infuriated many among the more than 40% of Egyptians who supported centrist, secular, and liberal candidates. An angry mob set fire to Shafiq's headquarters this week, and thousands of demonstrators gathered to protest in Cairo's Tahrir Square, site of the revolution that ousted Mubarak in February 2011. In a bid for their support, Mursi vowed to form a broad coalition government, saying the Superman era is over. Egypt is back to square zero, said Ahmed Mahmoud in Al-Abram in Egypt, as if there were no martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of the liberty of this nation. Our only hope is that whoever wins the runoff will find his power circumscribed by the military. Welcome to democracy, said Afshan Malavi in The National in the United Arab Emirates. Elections are messy and often unsatisfying. Now centrists have learned that if they want to win an election, they have to rally around a single candidate. It's not as bad as it looks, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The main takeaway is that the Muslim Brotherhood is not invincible. Though Mursi was backed by the only organized party, three-quarters of Egyptian voters picked someone else. Even if Mursi wins, said Fuad Ajami in the Wall Street Journal, he can't create a theocracy like Iran or Saudi Arabia. Egypt is far too dependent on foreign aid and tourism. And a Shafiq win would not be a simple return to the old regime, for a new republic has emerged. The outcome may not be ideal, but this is not the first time that the fruits of a revolution were picked by those who were strangers to its exertions. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week from The Week magazine. This week it's entitled, Obama's Spending, What the Numbers Really Say. Even by political standards, Mitt Romney has an utterly shameless disregard for the truth, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But a new analysis by the financial website MarketWatch.com may have uncovered Romney's biggest whopper yet, his charge that under Obama, federal spending has accelerated at a pace without precedent in recent history. The myth that Obama spends like a drunken sailor is so widespread, said Rex Nutting in MarketWatch.com, that even some Democrats believe it. But the numbers, unlike Romney, don't lie. Set aside the first part of the 2009 fiscal year, which began 4 months before Obama took office. With a budget largely set by the previous Congress, and federal spending has only increased by 1.4% during Obama's tenure. That's the lowest spending increase of any president since Dwight Eisenhower. The 2009 budget that George W. Bush handed Obama spent $3.52 trillion. Under Obama in 2010, federal spending actually fell to $3.46 trillion. Obama's 2013 budget calls for $3.58 trillion, very close to what the government spent in 2009. Contrast that record with Bush's 7.3% increase in spending during his first term, or Ronald Reagan's 8.7% increase during his first term. The bottom line, the famous Obama spending binge never happened. That's some creative and deceptive accounting, says James Taranto in WSJ.com. It's true that if you saddle George W. Bush with most of the 2009 federal budget, which raised spending by 17.9%, then Obama spending increases look rather modest. But 2009's budget contained about $400 billion in spending for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the bank bailout. That was supposed to be a one-time emergency measure. The budget for the ensuing years should have been smaller, But Obama carried on spending as if the 2008 emergency were permanent. Besides, said Investor's Business Daily in an editorial, spending measured in raw dollars is useless for historical analysis. What matters is spending as a percentage of gross domestic product. And Obama's average, 23.8% of GDP, is higher than it's ever been since World War II. Now there's a blatantly misleading argument, said the Tampa Bay Times PolitiFact.com. The main reason we're spending such a large percentage of our GDP is not that Obama's a big spender. He actually presided over a slight decrease in spending once you adjust for inflation. Our GDP has been dragged down by the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. That crisis, not incidentally, happened on Bush's watch. This entire conversation is nonsense, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. For Democrats to be crowing about Obama's modest spending is deeply disingenuous, since congressional Democrats tried to spend hundreds of billions more but were blocked by Republicans. The GOP could boast about that but won't, since they want to pretend that they've had no role in spending and the economy since Obama took office. To see how cynical this whole debate is, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, consider Romney's admission last week that he wouldn't make big spending cuts in his first year as president. If you take $1 trillion out of the first year of the federal budget, Romney said that would shrink GDP over 5%. Whoa, that's a big fat wet kiss to Keynesian economics and an admission that it's nuts to cut federal spending during a recession. The Republican nominee just repudiated the central argument his party has been making against Obama for the past 3 years. Who said Romney never tells the truth? And now from the controversy of the week, we'll turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for stoners with aspirations after author David Moranis' new biography of Barack Obama reported that in high school, the future president was a leader of a group of potheads called the Chum Gang and frequently bogarted that joint. It was a good week for feuds after Madonna pointedly segged from singing her 1989 song Express Yourself to Lady Gaga's very similar hit Born This Way as she began a worldwide tour in Tel Aviv. Madonna has accused Gaga of ripping off her song, a charge Gaga has called ridiculous. And it was a good week for mocking campaign finance law after new political action committees registered under such names as Talkin' Smack PAC, Bears for a Bearable Tomorrow, and Joe Six PAC. That's PAC, Political Action Committee. It was a bad week for oversharing after a 17-year-old Australian girl posted a picture on Facebook of a large stack of cash, her grandmother's life savings. Two masked men armed with a knife and a club promptly showed up at the girl's house. Since the cash was elsewhere, they robbed the girl's mom and stole some property. It was a bad week for the force after a man dressed as Darth Vader robbed a Toledo bank. The powerful Sith Lord used a semi-automatic pistol instead of the more traditional lightsaber. And it was a bad week for charity after motorist John Davis of Ohio tried to hand two $1 bills to a wheelchair-bound panhandler and dropped one of the bills on the ground. Minutes later, police gave Davis a $500 littering ticket. His offense was listed as throwing paper out the window. Now from Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4, we'll go to the People's section of the Week magazine. For this week, the first item is entitled Cole's Redheaded Pride. Lily Cole has suffered for being a ginger, says Martin Palmer in the Mail on Sunday in the United Kingdom. A supermodel with brains, she recently completed a dual degree program with honors at Britain's Cambridge University, has done some acting, and has a hand in a few businesses. But as a child, she was an outcast. I was bullied because I have red hair, she says. Actually, I think I was bullied because some kids bully sensitive children. I was of the type who gets bullied rather than the one who does the bullying, which I'm glad about. She was called Carrot Top and Ginger, schoolyard taunts that are familiar to any red-headed Briton. The names sound quite trivial. Now I wouldn't bat an eyelid. But it's not so much the words, it's the meanness behind saying such things to a child. After years of taunting, Cole came to assume that she'd face prejudice and hostility for the rest of her life because of her coloring. The irony is that I now love my hair, she says. Years ago, a man with red hair said to me, "All redheads go through the same journey. You'll hate it when you're younger, and then when you are older, you'll start dying it because you really want it black." And I think that is the trajectory. It's a wicked color to be. The next item is the supersonic skydiver. Felix Baumgartner wants to become the first human to break the sound barrier without the help of an airplane, said Matt Rudd in the Sunday Times in the UK. To achieve that goal, the Austrian daredevil, famed for jumping from the world's tallest buildings, will leap out of a helium balloon 23 miles above New Mexico and dive to Earth. He'll be in free fall for 5 minutes before opening a parachute at 5,000 feet. There are many dangers, but the greatest is that he'll enter an uncontrollable spin when he hits Mach 1. Supersonic speed will not destroy you because of air density, he says with no emotion. If you start flat spinning, the spin will get faster as you get slower and the air thickens. It will get so fast you won't be able to stop it anymore. Spinning at 150 RPM, there's only one way your blood can leave your body, and that's through your eyes. The truth is, no one really knows what will happen. This is uncharted territory. Baumgartner, who is 43, admits to fear, but he'll press ahead. I don't have to put myself into danger to be happy, he says, but I have to have a challenge. Doing all these jumps from buildings wasn't satisfying anymore. I've done everything I can think of. It was time to move on. And the next item from the People's section, Dinklage's stand against heightism. Peter Dinklage refuses to be defined by his height, said Brian Hyatt in Rolling Stone. As a child, his parents didn't make a big deal of his dwarfism. In fact, they never explained the condition to him. What do you need to explain, says the Game of Thrones star. It's like explaining your hands. You grow up with it. It's part of who you are. When Dinklage moved to New York in the early 90s to pursue an acting career, he refused to take any roles that exploited his 4'5" stature. He told producers he wouldn't play elves or leprechauns, even though those jobs paid well, and would have allowed Dinklage to move out of his rat-infested apartment. I feel it's the responsibility of people my size to persevere a bit more about what they do, he says, because it will just perpetuate itself if you agree to do these things. A similarly short friend of his recently appeared in the Snow White movie Mirror, Mirror. He was like, "Why did I do this?" You look on the top of the cabs in New York and the ad was 7 dwarfs. Dinklage shakes his head. "I can't do it. I have to play a person." Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Briefing section. And this week, the title of the article is "An Ever-Changing Union." Critics of gay marriage see it as an affront to sacred, time-tested traditions. How has marriage been defined in the past? Has marriage always had the same definition? Actually, the institution has been in a process of constant evolution. Pair bonding began in the Stone Age as a way of organizing and controlling sexual conduct and providing a stable structure for child rearing and the tasks of daily life. But that basic concept has taken many forms across different cultures and eras. Whenever people talk about traditional marriage or traditional families, historians throw up their hands, said Stephen Mintz, a history professor at Columbia University. We say when and where. The ancient Hebrews, for instance, engaged in polygamy. According to the Bible, King Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and men have taken multiple wives in cultures throughout the world, including China, Africa, and among American Mormons in the 19th century. Polygamy is still common across much of the Muslim world. The idea of marriage as a sexually exclusive romantic union between one man and one woman is a relatively recent development. Until two centuries ago, said Harvard historian Nancy Codd, monogamous households were a tiny, tiny portion of the world population, found in just Western Europe and little settlements in North America. When did people first start marrying? Well, the first recorded evidence of marriage contracts and ceremonies dates to 4,000 years ago in Mesopotamia. In the ancient world, marriage served primarily as a means of preserving power, with kings and other members of the ruling class marrying off daughters to forge alliances, acquire land, and produce legitimate heirs. Even in the lower classes, women had little say over whom they married. The purpose of marriage was the production of heirs, as implied by the Latin word matrimonium, which is derived from mater, which means mother. When did the church get involved? In ancient Rome, marriage was a civil affair governed by imperial law, but when the empire collapsed in the 5th century, church courts took over and elevated marriage to a holy union. As the church's power grew through the Middle Ages, so did its influence over marriage. In 1215, the marriage was declared one of the church's seven sacraments, alongside rites like baptism and penance. But it was only in the 16th century that the church decreed that weddings be performed in public by a priest and before witnesses. What role did love play? For most of human history, almost none at all. Marriage was considered too serious a matter to be based on such a fragile emotion. If love could grow out of it, that was wonderful, said Stephen Kuntz, author of Marriage, A History. But that was gravy. In fact, love and marriage were once widely regarded as incompatible with one another. A Roman politician was expelled from the Senate in the 2nd century B.C. for kissing his wife in public, behavior the essayist Plutarch condemned as disgraceful. In the 12th and 13th centuries, the European aristocracy viewed extramarital affairs as the highest form of romance, untainted by the gritty realities of daily life. And as late as the 18th century, the French philosopher Montesquieu wrote that any man who was in love with his wife was probably too dull to be loved by another woman. When did romance enter the picture? In the 17th and 18th centuries, when Enlightenment thinkers pioneered the idea that life was about the pursuit of happiness, they advocated marrying for love rather than wealth or status. This trend was augmented by the Industrial Revolution and the growth of the middle class in the 19th century, which enabled young men to select a spouse and pay for a wedding, regardless of parental approval. As people took more control of their love lives, they began to demand the right to end unhappy unions. Divorce became much more commonplace. Did marriage change in the 20th century? Dramatically. For thousands of years, law and custom enforced the subordination of wives to husbands. But as the women's rights movements gained strength in the late 19th and 20th centuries, wives slowly began to insist on being regarded as their husbands' equals rather than their property. By 1970, said Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of a Wife, a marriage law had become gender neutral in Western democracy. At the same time, the rise of effective contraception fundamentally transformed marriage. Couples could choose how many children to have, and even to have no children at all. If they were unhappy with each other, they could divorce, and nearly half of all couples did. Marriage had become primarily a personal contract between two equals, seeking love, stability, and happiness. This new definition opened the door to gays and lesbians claiming a right to be married, too. We now fit under the Western philosophy of marriage, said E. J. Graff, a lesbian and the author of What is Marriage For? In one very real sense, Kuntz says, opponents of gay marriage are correct when they say traditional marriage has been undermined. But for better or for worse, traditional marriage has already been destroyed, she says, and the process began long ago before anyone even dreamed of legalizing same-sex marriage. The footnote to this article is Gay Marriage in Medieval Europe. Same-sex unions aren't a recent invention. Until the 13th century, male bonding ceremonies were common in churches across the Mediterranean. Apart from the couple's gender, these events were almost indistinguishable from other marriages of the era. 12th century liturgies for same-sex unions, also known as spiritual brotherhoods, included the recital of marriage prayers, the joining of hands at the altar, and a ceremonial kiss. Some historians believe these unions were merely a way to seal alliances and business deals. But Eric Berkowitz, author of Sex and Punishment, says it is difficult to believe that these rituals did not contemplate erotic contact. In fact, it was the sex between the men involved that later caused same-sex unions to be banned. That happened in 1306 when the Byzantine Emperor Andronicus II declared such ceremonies, along with sorcery and incest, to be unchristian. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the best columns of the U.S. The first one is entitled, Why I Am Quitting Facebook. After I joined Facebook in 2008, said Steve Cole, I acquired 4,000 friends from all over the world. I enjoy the extraordinary emotional support of joining a virtual community. But as Facebook's initial offering of public stock recently demonstrated, there are many reasons to view this growing corporate behemoth with suspicion. Despite its new status as a public company, Facebook's two-tiered corporate governance system leaves its young ruler, Mark Zuckerberg, with near-total control over a pseudo-democratic realm. In Facebookistan, the company determines what citizens can and cannot post and pressures people to accept greater and greater losses of privacy so their personal information can be sold to advertisers. The loss of privacy will only grow as Facebook looks for new ways to commercialize the personal, cultural, political, and even revolutionary activity of users. Last week, I decided to exercise one of my rights as a citizen of this dystopian new society. I hit the settings button labeled Deactivate Account. The site demanded a reason for leaving. From a list, I chose I don't feel safe on Facebook. Farewell, friends. The next column is entitled The Demise of Sane Conservatism, and it was written by Michael Fumento in Salon.com. The conservative movement has gone off the track, said Michael Fumento. As a lifelong conservative who worked in the Reagan administration and has written of liberal folly for such publications as National Review and the Wall Street Journal, I am frequently dismayed and increasingly disgusted by the mass-produced hate and rage that passes for conservatism today. The new right has no respect for the civility and order embodied by Reagan. Its leaders are demagogues like Rush Limbaugh and rabid bloggers who routinely refer to ideological opponents as sluts and filthy freaks. There can be no dissent from the theological insistence that global warming is a hoax or that Barack Hussein Obama is a Marxist antichrist. No one dares to condemn loonies like Representative Alan West, a Florida Republican, who recently insisted that 78 to 81 congressional Democrats are members of the Communist Party. The rabid right traffics not in intellectually honest debate, but in moral panic, the terror that comes when society is undergoing a wrenching transformation. If saying so means that I, too, am now called an idiot, moron, duplicitous bastard, so be it. And our next column is entitled, Did Obama's Camp Try to Bribe Right? Written by Byron York in the Washington Examiner. If anyone needs further proof of the media's double standard, said Byron York, consider its treatment of two books about presidential candidates. In 1999, convicted felon J.H. Hatfield claimed in a book called Fortunate Son that George W. Bush had been arrested in Texas for cocaine possession in 1972, but got off when his father pulled some strings. The New York Times assigned reporters to find proof of the arrest. When they came up with nothing, that newspaper and others still managed to run articles mentioning the book's allegations. Contrast that to the reception of Edward Klein's best-selling book about Barack Obama, The Amateur. Klein quotes Obama's longtime pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, as saying he was offered $150,000 in 2008 by a personal friend of Obama's, Dr. Eric Whitaker, to remain silent until after the election. The media has totally ignored this claim. I've heard the taped interview with Wright, who plainly says the Obama camp tried to buy his silence. I wonder, why isn't that worth investigating? Now, from the Week magazine, we'll flip to the back of the magazine to the article called The Last Word. This week, this particular article is entitled Inside North Korea's Gulag, Twisted by Hunger and Cruelty. The Boy Betrayed His Mother, says Blaine Harden, and then watched her hang. 9 years after watching his mother's hanging, Shin In-gyun squirmed through the electric fence that surrounds Camp 14 and ran off through the snow into the North Korean wilderness. It was January 2, 2005. Before then, no one born in a North Korean political prison camp had ever escaped. As far as can be determined, Shin is the only one to have done it. He was 23 years old, and he knew no one outside the fence. Within a month, he had walked into China. Within 2 years, he was living in South Korea. 4 years later, he was living in Southern California. Shin is roughly the same age as Kim Jong-un, the chubby third son of Kim Jong-il, who took over as leader after his father's death in 2011. Shin was born a slave and raised behind a high-voltage barbed wire fence. His mother beat him, and he viewed her as a competitor for food. His father, who was allowed by guards to sleep with his mother just 5 nights a year, ignored him. His older brother was a stranger. Children in the camp were untrustworthy and abusive. Before he learned anything else, Shin learned to survive by snitching on all of them. Love and mercy and family were words without meaning. Many years later, after she was dead and he was living in the United States, he would tell me that he loved his mother. But that was in retrospect. That was after he learned that a civilized child should love his mother. She never talked to him about her past, her family, or why she was in the camp, and he never asked. His existence as her son had been arranged by guards. They chose her and the man whom became Shen's father as prizes for each other in a reward marriage. The eighth rule of Camp 14, as Shin was required to memorize it, said should sexual physical contact occur without prior approval, the perpetrators will be shot immediately. If unauthorized sex resulted in a pregnancy or a birth, the woman and her baby were usually killed. As school wound down on Friday, April 5th, 1996, Shen's teacher surprised him. He told Shen that he could go home and eat supper with his mother. Shen did not particularly want to spend the night at his mother's place. The teacher, however, told him to go home, so he went. When Shen got there, he discovered that his brother, He Gyun, had come home too. Shen's mother was not delighted when her youngest son showed up unexpectedly for supper. She did not say welcome or that she had missed him. Then she cooked, using her daily ration of 700 grams of cornmeal, to make porridge in the one pot she owned. She and her sons ate on the kitchen floor. After he had eaten, Shen went to sleep in the bedroom. Voices from the kitchen woke him up. He peeked through the bedroom door, curious about what his mother and brother were up to. His mother was cooking rice. For Shen, this was a slap in the face. He had been served a watery corn soup, the same tasteless gruel he had eaten every day of his life. Now his brother was getting rice. It is difficult to overstate the importance of rice in North Korean culture. It signifies wealth, evokes the closeness of family, and sanctifies a proper meal. Labor camp prisoners almost never eat rice, and its absence is a daily reminder of the normality they can never have. In the bedroom, Shen fumed. He also listened. He, Gyun, his brother, had not been given the day off. Without permission, he had walked away from his work post, where he had apparently done something wrong. Shen's mother and brother were discussing what they should do. Escape. Shen was astonished to hear the word. His brother said it. He was planning to run. His mother was helping him. Her precious hoard of rice was food for flight. Shen's heart pounded. He was angry that she would put his life at risk for the sake of his older brother. He was afraid he would be implicated in the escape and shot. He was also jealous that his brother was getting rice. As the aggrieved 13-year-old struggled to contain his fear, Shen's camp-bred instincts took over. He had to tell a guard. He got up off the floor and went to the kitchen and headed out the door. Shen ran back to his school. It was 1 a.m. He entered the school dormitory, woke his friend Hong Song-jo, and found a guard. Shen said he had something to tell him in exchange for more food and being made grade leader at school. The guard agreed. Shen explained what his brother and mother were planning and where they were. The guard telephoned his superiors. He told Shen and Hong to go back to the dormitory and get some sleep. He would take care of everything. On the morning after he betrayed his mother and brother, uniformed men came to the schoolyard for Shen. He was handcuffed, blindfolded, pushed into the back seat of a jeep, and driven away in silence to an underground prison inside the camp. "At dawn today, your mother and your brother were caught trying to escape," Shen was told. "That's why you're here. Understand? Were you aware of this fact or not? How is it possible for you not to know that your mother and brother tried to run away? If you want to live, you should spit out the truth." "I was more faithful to guards than to my family." On that morning, in the underground prison, Shen understood nothing. He was a bewildered 13-year-old. The officer with 4 stars kept asking him about the whys, whens, and hows of his family's escape plan. Shen was unable to say anything coherent. Interrogators tortured Shen for several days, grilling him about the attempted escape. What grudges did his mother harbor? What did he discuss with her? What were his brother's intentions? They stripped Shen, tied ropes to his ankles and wrists, and suspended him from a hook in the ceiling. They lowered him over a fire. A few days after that bout of torture, Shen managed to explain that he was the one who had betrayed his mother and brother. The sessions ended when Hong, Shen's friend, who had helped him inform, confirmed what had happened. The guards carried Shen, too weak to walk, to a cramped cell, his new home. After several months, the guards took Shen to the same prison chamber room where, in early April, he had first been interrogated. Now it was late November. Shen had just turned 14. He had not seen the sun for more than half a year. What he saw in the room startled him. His father knelt in front of two interrogators who sat at their desks. He seemed much older and more careworn than before. He had been brought into the underground prison at about the same time as Shin. His father's right leg canted outward unnaturally. He had also been tortured. Below his knee, his leg bones had been broken, and they had knitted back together at an odd angle. The injury would end his relatively comfortable job as a camp mechanic and lathe operator. He would now have to hobble around as an unskilled laborer on a construction crew. Shin and his father were handcuffed, blindfolded, and led to the elevator. Above ground, they were guided into the back seat of a small car and driven away. When the car stopped after about 30 minutes and Shin's blindfold was removed, he panicked. A crowd had gathered at the empty wheat field near his mother's house. This was the place where Shin had witnessed two or three executions a year since he was a toddler. A makeshift gallows had been constructed and a wooden pole had been driven into the ground. Shin was now certain that he and his father were to be executed. He became acutely aware of the air passing into and out of his lungs. His panic subsided when a guard barked out his father's name. "Hey, Gyung Sub, go sit at the very front." Shin was told to go with his father. A guard removed their handcuffs. They sat down. The officer overseeing the execution began to speak. Shin's mother and brother were dragged out. "Execute Jang Hai Jung and Shen He Gyun, traitors of the people," the senior officer said. Shin looked at his father. He was weeping silently. The shame Shen feels about the executions has been compounded over the years by the lies he began telling in South Korea. For years after his escape from the camp, he said that he learned of his brother's escape attempt only when the guards told him. He said nothing about snitching on his mother and brother, or of selling them out for a bowl of rice and an easier job in the camp. "There is nothing in my life to compare with this burden," Shen told me. But he was not ashamed on the day of the executions. He hated his mother and brother with the savage clarity of a wronged and wounded adolescent. As he saw it, he had been tortured and nearly died, and his father had been crippled because of their foolish, self-centering scheming. When guards dragged her to the gallows, Shen saw that his mother looked bloated. They forced her to stand on a wooden box, gagged her, tied her arms behind her back, and tightened a noose around her neck. They did not cover her swollen eyes. She scanned the crowd and found Shin. He refused to hold her gaze. When guards pulled away the box, she jerked about desperately. As he watched his mother struggle, Shin thought she deserved to die. Shin's brother looked gaunt and frail as guards tied him to the wooden post. Three guards fired their rifles three times. Bullets snapped the pole that held his forehead to the pole. It was a bloody, brain-splattered mess of a killing, a spectacle that sickened and frightened Shin. But he thought his brother, too, had deserved it. Shin invented a lie about his family's fate and his role in it just before arriving in South Korea. "There were a lot of things I needed to hide," he said. "I was terrified of a backlash of people asking me, 'Are you even human?' Outsiders have a wrong understanding of the camp. It is not just the soldiers who beat us. It is the prisoners themselves who are not kind to each other. There is no sense of community. I am one of those mean prisoners." Shin said he did not expect forgiveness. He said he had not forgiven himself. He also seemed to be trying to do something more than expiate guilt. He wanted to explain in a way that he acknowledged would damage his credibility as a witness, how the camp had warped his character. He said that if outsiders could understand what political prison camps have done and are doing to children born inside the fence, it would redeem his lie and his life. And this article was reprinted by arrangement with Viking Penguin, a member of the Penguin Group. And it's from Escape from Camp 14, written by Blaine Harden in 2012. ¶¶ Now, in our reading of the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the Talking Points section. Our first article here is entitled, Men, the Threat of Technology Enchantment. The modern male is in trouble, said Philip Zimbardo and Nikita Duncan in CNN.com. Males now make up less than 45% of many college classes, and far fewer young men in their 20s than young women rate their careers as a major priority. A whole generation of male slackers are failing to find jobs, get out of their parents' houses, and even land steady girlfriends. We think we know why. Technology enchantment. All kinds of modern technology, especially online porn and video games, have trained young men to crave instant gratification. Hooked on arousal, they spend hours each day getting little bursts of pleasure every time they achieve some success in the stunningly realistic 3D world of video games, or click on an explicit new sex video on sites that cater to every fantasy. Their addicted brains are being rewired in a totally new way that demands constant stimulation. As a direct consequence, they find school, jobs, and long-term relationships to be painfully boring. That explains everything, said Colin Campbell in IGN.com. Young dudes can't find any real-world pursuits as interesting as MILF lesbo honeys or Call of Duty, so the fate of humanity is at stake. It's only a matter of time before civilization collapses, with vines slowly growing among billions of corpses slouched in front of computer screens, their skulls set forever in a strange grin. People have been wringing their hands over the end of masculinity for generations, said David Thier in Forbes.com. They did it when men left the farms for factories, and probably when they started using bows and arrows instead of throttling deer with their own two hands. This is just the latest twist on an age-old lament. Kids these days, when will they learn? There's no doubt that addiction to video games and porn is real, said Brian Fung in TheAtlantic.com. But Zimbardo, a well-known social psychologist, presents zero scientific evidence that most video gamers or porn site visitors are addicts. His sweeping indictment of a generation of men relies on a few lurid anecdotes, like Norwegian mass killer Anders Behring Breivik's obsession with World of Warcraft. Yes, many young men are struggling, but the global economic downturn, changing gender roles, and other social trends surely must play some role. Blaming all their problems on technology enchantment is a tad simplistic, don't you think? The next article is entitled, Newspapers, a Sad Milestone in New Orleans. In New Orleans, loyal readers reacted with a combination of shock, incredulity, anger, and sadness, said John Pope in the Washington Post. The city's beloved 175-year-old newspaper, the Times-Picayune, announced this week that it will publish only 3 days a week, slash its staff by a third, and move precious remaining resources to an online edition. It's a last-ditch effort to stanch huge losses in advertising and circulation following Hurricane Katrina in 2005. When that storm brought the city to its knees, said David Carr in the New York Times, the professional journalists of the Times-Picayune did their jobs, even as their families dispersed and their houses were underwater. The newspaper steadfast worked, reunited families, and brought order out of incredible chaos. Over the years, the Times-Picayune has exposed rogue cops, corrupt politicians, and a broken prison system. But can a newspaper play a vital role in a community when it doesn't land day after day on doorsteps? It's not paper and ink we should care about saving, said Jeff Jarvis in BuzzMachine.com. It's the journalism and service. As the web grows in importance and reach, 14 daily papers have closed since 2007. Only a hybrid print-online model will save more papers from going under. Still, it will be an uncertain transition, said Nate Ives in Ad Age. On the web, newspapers give their content away for free, and online ads cost just a fraction of what print ads do. The Times-Picayune, for example, took in $64.7 million last year in print advertising, but only $5.7 million via its website. Online revenue won't pay for the kind of crusading journalism produced by the Times-Picayune, let alone that of a larger newspaper. To avoid slow suicide, newspapers must swallow hard and start charging for online content, said David Simon in the Columbia Journalism Review. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have already embraced the paywall, and they are seeing significant revenue, tens of millions of dollars. Other major newspapers must follow. Once the stories in the big dailies are no longer shipped around the web for free, papers like the Times-Picayune can start charging for local content, too, maybe at half or a third of the cost of print delivery. Those who shout that information wants to be free don't understand a very basic fact. Until newspapers recover a revenue stream for their online product, they have no future. And now, as we reach the end of our program, we'll take a look at a few short items here from the Talking Points section. The first one, for the first time in U.S. history, neither of the two major presidential candidates has ever served in the military. So far, President Obama and Democratic groups supporting him have raised $450 million for the 2012 campaign. Mitt Romney and Republican groups backing him have raised $400 million. The two campaigns and super PACs will together spend close to $2 billion, by far the most expensive election ever held in the U.S. Of the 375 tons of heroin grown for export in Afghanistan each year, only 3.5% is intercepted by Afghan authorities, according to the UN. Another item, as diabetes rates rise worldwide, so does the illegal trade in human kidneys. The World Health Organization estimates that 10,000 black market operations a year are being performed in places like China, Pakistan, and India as doctors transplant kidneys purchased from poor donors for as little as $5,000 into richer patients who are paying up to $200,000. And military veterans are filing for disability benefits at a record rate. 1.6 million veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, 45% are seeking compensation for service-related injuries, compared with the estimated 21% who filed for disability benefits after the Gulf War in the 1990s. And from the Poll Watch, among those reached by landline phones, Mitt Romney beats President Obama by 3 percentage points in Florida and 1 percentage point in Virginia. But among those polled via cell phones, Obama leads by 57% to 34% in Florida and 54% to 36% in Virginia. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.